Connect. People. Potential. Technology.
John Klepper is a seasoned serial entrepreneur with over 19 years of experience founding and scaling technology-driven companies. He has led multiple ventures across various stages of growth, including two successful exits, and currently serves on several boards. John brings deep expertise in lean startup methodologies, operational leadership, organizational structuring, strategic planning, and capital raising. His passion lies in bridging technology and healthcare to create meaningful impact. As the founder of Pipra, a Zurich-based digital health startup, John is pioneering the use of AI and high-quality patient data to revolutionize the prediction, prevention, and diagnosis delirium. Under his leadership, Pipra is at the forefront of innovation in the digital health space. John, thank you so much for joining us at the Swiss Capricorn podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Jacob. I'm grateful to be here and have the opportunity to talk a little bit about what we do and at Pipra and maybe a little bit about my background.
John, I always start the podcast with a question. What was your first encounter with the digital world in your life? Do you remember that?
The first encounter with the digital world. So earlier in my life, career, I was more in the arts, painter, sculptor, then photographer. And then I went into the film industry, worked in the film industry for several years. And during that phase, I moved into entrepreneurship, started a production company in Los Angeles and with some friends, and then one in Sweden and so on and so on. So I guess the introduction would have been in the early days of digital photography, where I started to get a little bit familiar with the digital field. And then part of my master's was also in digital media. So I started early days of Macintosh and using digital assets and manipulating them through digital media.
Were you always a bit of an entrepreneur in your life? Were there early signs already that you wanted to go this entrepreneurial journey?
I guess the earliest signs might have been that I was severely dyslexic. I'm told that a lot of entrepreneurs have dyslexia or ADHD or various different types of neurodiversity, let's say. I think, you know, the entrepreneurial mind, I think, is one, and I think I can relate to that. It's one where you're always looking at the world through a lens, through a perspective of how can something be a little bit better, a little bit faster, a little bit more innovative, you know, like in everyday life. If I'm making myself a coffee or if I'm traveling somewhere, or it would be great if there was an app that did this, or, you know, if there was a way that just made it so much simpler for people, you know, and you go through life constantly thinking like that. And then at certain points you fall in love with some idea. And if that coincides with a business opportunity and a market opportunity, you know, some USP or something, then you have the opportunity to, you know, look to create something potentially magical.
And the connection between entrepreneurship and dyslexia, you said, where is that coming from?
It's a good question. I think, and this is also from, you know, some studies that I've read and some books on the topic. I think what happens from an early age is people who have some kind of, you know, let's say neurodivergence or some sort of challenges, right, at an early age, they end up having to try to find other pathways to get to where they need to get, you know, to pass an exam or to, you know, do what everybody else is doing. It's not that straightforward. It's not that easy. So you have to find other ways, and you start having to think outside the box, and you start trying to focus on what you're really good at, because you know there's certain things you're not good at. And sometimes those things you're good at, you end up excelling, you know, significantly more so than others, maybe because you have the challenges in other areas. So for me, the arts opened up really early on as a strength and a place that I could focus. But at the same time, entrepreneurship also was somehow in that direction. It was a place for me to tap into a part of my brain that got excited about challenges and finding different ways to solve a problem. Because that's what you're doing. You're trying to solve problems, right? And dyslexia is a problem. It's a challenge.
So it sounds a bit like you're almost creating your own superpower. So creating out of lead a gold. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, it's funny you use that term because I was having some drinks on a rooftop in Silicon Valley with investors, some of whom had invested in PIPRA, the company that I'm currently running. And we started talking about our backgrounds, and I mentioned, you know, at some point that I was dyslexic or had dyslexia. And he said, "Oh, me too." And he said, "That's your superpower." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, don't you know, like, there's a lot of very successful entrepreneurs who are dyslexic. It's kind of like a fairly large percentage." And I sort of looked into it afterwards, and yeah, there's some truth to that. So maybe it is in some ways a superpower. I don't know. It doesn't come with a cape. Yeah.
And with PIPRA, you founded such a fascinating company with such an interesting product, prevention of delirium. What was your motivation in founding PIPRA?
It's a couple of different things. So firstly, as I mentioned, this lens that you go through life looking for opportunities. I was working in Alzheimer's disease, early detection and prevention.
So you had the experience already in that field?
In a similar field, yeah. Also using early days of artificial intelligence to try to analyze and predict certain patterns in gait and executive function and spatial awareness and things like that. And on that journey, I started to learn about delirium, which I didn't know anything about at the time. And I discovered that delirium has very similar characteristics, traits to dementia, but it's much more acute. So the onset is sudden most often. And so in essence, a patient in hospital, for example, will be fine after surgery, but then some hours later will suddenly go into severe discomfort, disorientation, hallucination. Many patients will describe it as the most terrifying experience of their life. And so you can see a dramatic change from one minute to the other. And the effect of that is that the patient will stay in hospital much longer. They will have a lot of complications as a result of delirium in terms of increased risk of falls, infections, readmission rates, all kinds of different things that can be attributed to the delirium. And I realized that nothing was being done about it. It was something that was affecting a significant percentage of the population, so nearly one in four patients over 60. Admitted to a hospital for any reason, will suffer from delirium. And many of those patients will end up with long-term cognitive complications. They'll go from their home to the hospital and then from the hospital to a nursing home.
Is the decline very fast or a slow decline of the patients?
It can be both. Mm-hmm. In some cases, a patient will decline very rapidly and die within a month. It's quite a large percentage of patients that will pass away within a month. Some will just slowly the complications will increase over time. But generally, within a few months, you can see that, you know, patients and relatives, sometimes even within days, hours, patients and relatives will experience significant change. So what is very often said or heard is, you know, my mom was never the same, or my father, my dad was never the same after surgery or after, you know. And unfortunately, up until recently, a lot of clinicians as well as patients and relatives just assumed that, you know, some people are unlucky and it's a consequence of hospitals, of surgeries, perhaps, right? And now we know that that's not necessarily the case, that it is very preventable, and that you shouldn't leave the hospital worse than when you arrived. So a lot of patients, it's very sad. You know, they go in for a hip surgery, for example, and they're cognitively fine, and then they come out, their hip might be fine, but they end up in a nursing home, and they don't remember who their kids are. That's not a trade-off most people are willing to take. Mm. And the second reason was because my mother had delirium. So about 15 years ago or so, she had a surgery, a hip fracture, and just like I described, she woke up in a completely disoriented, confused state. She thought the staff were trying to kill her. She saw monsters coming out of the walls, and she was terrified for several days. So luckily, she recovered. She made a full recovery, and she's doing fine. But she's terrified of hospitals and won't go near one. So, that's not a good outcome. And we can do better. And so at PIPRA, this was the motivation, and now at PIPRA, we've developed AI algorithms and software solutions to help to predict which patients are at risk on admission, just runs in the background, and then highlight which patients need preventive measures, so it's tailored to those specific patients. And in the balance, it's extremely cost-effective for hospitals to be able to target prevention on patients that are at high risk and to reduce that incidence significantly, reduce length of stay, reduce nursing hours, all these things.
So basically, you created a system, a technology that scans patients who need certain preventive measures or who are, let's say, more inclined for this disease,
nope.
for the delirium, or nope. how would you describe it?
The scanning, mm-hmm. let's say, it's we can clarify what that is in a moment, happens on all patients over 60. And it happens in real time, and it runs in the background, so there's no extra time needed. The reason it's done on all patients over 60 is because delirium is very multifaceted, and it's very difficult to predict. So if a patient is very high risk, and it's relatively easy for clinicians to predict. If a patient comes to the hospital at 85 years old, 90 years old, and they've, got all kinds of different comorbidities, they're multi-medicated, it's the high likelihood that they're going to be delirious as well. And you don't really need a software to tell you that. But it's the patients that are medium risk to high risk that get missed all the time. These are patients that, might also be 85, 90, but they're physically fine. They could be 60, physically fine, mentally sharp, but they end up with delirium. And this is where artificial intelligence can help highlight those high-risk patients with accuracy.
And John, what is your vision for PIPRA?
So our vision is a world without delirium. And delirium is the first disease area that we're focused on in the neurocognitive space. So there's lots of other areas that we can move into, like dementia. But having said that, delirium is such a large problem that we have our hands full for quite some time. And to give you some perspective, it's 60% more expensive to healthcare than diabetes in the United States. That's in the United Wow. States, where diabetes, as we all know, is a significant problem. It affects well over 60 million people per year that we know about.
In the U.S.?
Worldwide.
Worldwide.
60
mm-hmm.
million people. And that's the actual number is probably much higher than that because 70% of cases are missed. That's also something that we're trying to solve to make sure that patients aren't missed. So, it's affecting, easily 200 million people a year or more. And there's something that can be done about it. These patients don't have to have cognitive complications. And our mission is to ensure that they leave the hospital better than they arrived, not worse.
How could you reduce, just give me some numbers maybe, okay, let's say 60 million potential patients, and then how could you reduce this number with your technology?
Yeah, so it's not 60 million potential, 60 million people that have
that have it,
that get delirium,
that
per,
get delirium
per year.
Okay.
Yeah, that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
How do we prevent it?
How can you reduce the number with your technology?
Yeah.
With how much percentage could you reduce it?
Yeah. So the studies are quite conclusive that you can reduce the incidence by up to 43%. So far, we've shown a 29% reduction in delirium through using PIPRA, not in a study, but in a clinical setting. The results that were published by one of our customers in a peer-reviewed high-impact journal. And that's already significant. So almost 30% of the patients that were seen by, scanned by PIPRO were reduced from delirium within our target population. So, and perhaps it's interesting to know how we do that. So that's just the reduction on the incidence. And as a result of that, there's also a reduction in nursing hours, 19 hours per nurse, per patient.
Mm-hmm.
For 19 hours per patient. So often multiple nurses attending to a specific patient. And in totality, it's 19 hours reduced per patient. And about 2.5 million Swiss francs per 1,000 patients screened. Savings to the hospital.
Save the hospital.
Yeah.
And so it's not a pharma product. It's pure technology, AI-based technology. But what about the pharma companies? I mean, big pharma must hate you because it's not a pharma product. It's pure technology. What do you say?
No, not at all. Not at all. And the reason for that is because there is still today no magic pill for delirium.
Oh, okay.
So if you have delirium, you're pretty much stuck with it.
There's no pharmaceutical product for that disease?
No. The only thing that gets prescribed to a delirious patient typically is a sedative to try to calm them, relax them. Mm. If there is a magic pill, if they do come up with a treatment for delirium, or even a preventive pill for delirium, then they're still going to want to know which patients that should be administered with this drug, right? They're not going to give it to all patients. So in that case, we would be a perfect companion to that drug, where we would highlight for the pharmaceutical company which patients needed the drug, which ones were at high risk. So if anything, we would work well together with them.
Okay, it would be a good positive collaboration with Big Pharma.
Exactly.
And John, what were the challenges in your entrepreneurial journey now with PIPRA? Maybe you can also elaborate a little bit on that.
We haven't had any challenges. Said no entrepreneur ever.
Yeah, exactly. No problems. It was just like a smooth sailing.
So smooth.
Right? So maybe our listeners can also identify.
I would say, so when you're working in a space and you're pioneering and opening up a new market, essentially, there's a lot of challenges in terms of awareness. Nowadays, so we've been doing this for a few years now, but nowadays more and more hospitals and clinicians and insurance companies are aware of the impact of delirium, so it's a little bit less education and awareness now. But when we started, that was definitely one of the challenges. So often a hospital will know that delirium is a problem, but they won't know how big a problem it is.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be at the top of their priority list, right? That's starting to change.
So more awareness now in the market.
Yeah. So that's definitely, you know, was one of the challenges. We had some interesting challenges around being in Switzerland because we started off with a government grant from the European Union, from EIT Health. And then halfway through that grant, Switzerland decided that they were no longer going to be in the framework agreement with Europe. So our funding disappeared overnight. And, you know, that was actually very, very challenging, but also a beautiful moment for us because, especially as founders, so I have two amazing co-founders, Nayeli Schmutz, she's an anesthesiologist, about 15 years of clinical practice. Ben, who's a scientist, cell biologist, who worked at Roche and Pfizer, did his PhD at Oxford. You know, we, through that challenge, we really came together and bonded and kind of just bootstrapped and figured out a way to survive. And I think that, you know, these type of challenges for startups will either tear a company apart or it will bring them closer together, usually. And in this case, for us, it brought us closer together. And there's other challenges, of course, around raising capital, especially in today's climate. It's very difficult. Expectations from investors has changed a lot. So there's challenges there. You know, it takes longer to close investment rounds. Sales is, of course, a challenge whenever you're selling into hospital systems or insurance or healthcare systems. There's slow sales cycles and a lot of different stakeholders that are involved. So that presents a challenge on the cash flow side. The good news or the good part of that is that once you're in, it's very sticky and they tend to, you know, they have long contracts and they stay with you for a long time. So that's, if you can survive that long, then you can end up with a very nice customer base.
Do you have any advice to other entrepreneurs to start off bootstrapping or start initially with external investors, or there's no general advice for that kind of financing?
I think it's very dependent on what it is you're doing. You know, if you're developing molecules, biotech, medtech that requires, you know, expensive hardware, you're obviously going to need a lot of capital to do that. So to say bootstrap, you know, and build a new turbine for planes, you know, it's unlikely. But in some cases, especially if you're doing B2C type, you know, solutions, if you can build something in your garage or you can, you know, test the market with something like a prototype quite quickly and easily without a lot of capital needs, then I would definitely advise to do that. Build a customer base, get a little bit of traction, and then try to get some capital if you need it. Of course, there are those exceptional situations where a company builds something quickly, puts it on the market, there's immediate demand, and they don't need capital. But even then, when it starts to go really well, you start getting a lot of potential competitors start looking into the market, and then that's where you have to make a decision. Should I bring in additional capital so that we go faster, that we take on more market share before the competitors, the incumbents start coming in? It's raising capital is part of the game for the vast majority.
And with Pipra, with your technology, do you have the first mover advantage?
We do. Particularly in prevention. So there's a few companies that have moved into the space in diagnosis. And that's great, it's needed. But the problem with delirium, as I described before, is that once you have it, you're kind of stuck with it, right? There's no magic pill. So it's important to know who has delirium, but there's not much you can do about it. Whereas if you predict which patients are at risk, then you can do very effective prevention measures and make sure the patient doesn't get delirium. And that has the effect of first ensuring a better outcome for the patient, and the relatives are happier
And then it also reduces length of stay. It reduces nursing hours, costs in general. So all these other type of complications get reduced. So,
and can you also completely prevent the outbreak of the delirium, the disease, once you detect it or preconceived it?
Yes, you can completely prevent delirium. Mm-hmm. Not at 100%, of course. That doesn't really exist in medicine, but
significantly yes. Reduce the risk of the outbreak yes. of the disease. Okay, correct. Very good. Do you have also competitors at the moment in the market with this type of technology?
Currently, we're still the only one.
So the only one who provides this technology.
Yeah, that's certified as a medical device. So that's also an area where we have some business protection because if a hospital wants to build their own solution, for example, right, which is very difficult because 70% of cases are missed. But if they decided they wanted to try and build one, a couple of hospitals have done that, then they would need to go through the whole certification process to get it certified as a medical device, which is very expensive, takes a lot of time, and most hospitals don't bother doing that. And then, well, of course, once they have it, then they can use it. If they did do that, they could use it for their own purposes in hospital, for that one hospital. But then if they wanted to then sell it, they would need to have a sales team and a marketing team and a whole, like, basically company or spin out that would have to take care of the whole go-to-market part, right? And again, that's something most hospitals don't do, with a few exceptions.
And John, now with your experience as a serial entrepreneur, what advice would you give a startup manager, entrepreneur, or founder when they start a business? I mean, is there anything particular that comes to your mind?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. Talk to a lot of founders who have got experience. I think that's really key is to, if you can, find co-founders who are multidisciplinary, who are complementary to your skills. That bring a different perspective, challenge you, and that you trust. Very, very important. A lot of solo founders struggle because they don't have that that challenge at the top level, the different perspective. But also in difficult times, they don't have that person or those people to lean on and to, you know, it's like any relationship. You are never going to be 100% both of you at the same time, right? You know, this idea that a relationship should be 50-50, I think that's okay some of the time, but there's going to be other times where one person is doing really well and the other person isn't. And then that person doing really well needs to pick up the slack and try to help out, right? Bring the other person on the journey and, you know, make sure that they're doing okay.
So it's kind of a leader-follower situation, or is it more a complementary, one person is good at this thing and the other person
complementary.
Is...
Okay. Yeah. So the co-founding thing is definitely advised. And in fact, a lot of investors won't invest in solo entrepreneurs because of that. I guess some other advice would be talk to your customer as often as you can and with a very curious mind and ask every question you can think of and document those questions and make sure that what you are building is solving a real need, a real problem, right? And that it's something that their customer would actually want and the way they would want it, right?
So there has to be a real problem, a real need in the market. Can you also be successful in a saturated market?
Yeah, of course. I mean, not overly saturated, mm-hmm. saturated, then probably not. But mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, often, you know, the third, fourth, fifth company in a specific space becomes the big success, right? Maybe those first ones are kind of paving the path a little bit. And it also depends, I guess, on just how big the market is, right? If you're talking about social media, you know, there's a lot of people in the world, so there can be more space for more than one social media platform, right?
Absolutely.
It depends what you're trying to do.
John, I would like to talk also about finding the best talent. What was your experience when you were hiring people for Pipra? What were the challenges, especially if, you're maybe not so well known or not with a multinational company or not like have the name Roche or Novartis, for example?
A challenge with hiring and when you're a small team is a big one is time. It takes a lot of time. So, you got to work with an HR company or do posts or a bit of both, and you have to go through a lot of CVs and you've got to do interviews with multiple candidates and then repeat interviews. And then you need to negotiate the contract and the terms, and there's a lot of back and forth, and the whole process can take months. So it's time is, I think, one of the biggest challenges. I think it's underestimated by a lot of startups just how critical it is to find not just really talented people that fit the job description, but people who you want to work with, people who you like, people who you want to spend time with, that you feel like they're part of your tribe or that they, you know, yeah, I mean, you're going to be spending every single day with these people pretty much, and sometimes nights and weekends, so you want to make sure you get along. And some people you click with and some people you have, you know, you can sort of feel there could be some friction, so you want to stay away from that. So having a good radar and also bringing lots of different people from the company to do into the interview process so that they all have their own radar is very important.
Some different perspectives from the company.
Yeah, because you might not pick up on something that, you know, others. I'm told that that's a really good thing to do when you are trying to avoid hiring a narcissist.
Like getting a different perspective from different people.
Narcissists are very good at disguising who they really are, but they're sort of chameleons, and they will sort of play the role very well, right? So it's easy to miss. But they're not so good at playing the role when you're several people, because now they're feeling like there's lots of people watching them, and they get a little razzled, right? Because it's an act. So maybe one of them is going to figure out that it's an act, right? So this is what I've read and heard. But also just, you know, you have different perspectives that will chime in, and if everybody says, I think this person is great, probably it's a good hire. If one or two people are like, not sure, then you might want to question why you think they're great, and maybe you're wrong, right? So that's, I think, very important. Mm-hmm. And then attracting the right talent is challenging. And there, I think having a good presence in social media is important. Communicating what you're doing, why you're doing it, you know, if it's an impactful project, you know, making sure that that's very clear, and make sure that your culture comes through, that you have the right culture, and that that's expressed and very clear to the candidate or candidates.
And how do you retain good talent?
So culture is probably the number one, making sure that that the, you know, the person feels appreciated, safe, inspired, motivated in the right way, and that they have room to grow. I think, you know, part of doing that well is having one-on-ones fairly frequently, where it's a bi-directional conversation. And that's actually something that I used to do regularly with everybody on my team, and then I stopped doing that for a while, and I regret not doing that continuously, because, you know, you can think and feel like, oh, everything's fine, mm-hmm. but and then all of a sudden you realize, like, okay, wait, no, somebody's actually quite upset about something, and you didn't really know just how upset they were about something. Whereas if you'd had regular one-to-ones, that would have probably surfaced, mm-hmm. and you could have done that something about it earlier. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important.
And did you proactively create a culture? Did you sit down at the beginning and said, okay, this is what I stand for, this is what PIPRA stands for, these are our values?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we did that very early on. And it was actually really fun process, because, you know, we have three very different founders who all have their own values. We all three have our own things that we feel are important in life. And then it's about, okay, what do we want our shared values to be as a company? And that's kind of a fun exercise to do. We probably ended up with too many. We probably still need to filter down a little bit. I think we have 7 or something, 8. So,
can you give an example of promoting also the culture within the organization?
Well, first of all, when we hire somebody, we start off with a welcome, like day one, everybody together. This is who we are. They introduce themselves and we talk about the company and the culture and why that's important. We also have it on the wall, so it's in our office, very clear to everybody. These are our cultures. But mostly it's about living them. And
can you give an example maybe there? What does that mean, living them?
You know, one of our values is mutual respect. So
okay.
Living that, being mutually respectful to one another. You know, humility is one of them, like trying to be humble. And those kinds of things also come across when you talk outside of the company, when you talk to other partners, key opinion leaders, potential customers. You know, like if you come in humble, you probably get further than if you come in like, we're the expert and we know. You know. So sometimes it's a little mix. If you're talking to a customer, of course, you need to show some confidence and some, you know, portray credibility, but there's a way to do that and that's humble as well, humbling. We had a funny incident actually once where one of the values, humility, fell off the wall. So that day we just went wild. We were bragging like crazy.
How would you, for example, okay, you want to test a candidate on humility. Like, how would you test the candidate?
I don't really think it's so much about testing mm-hmm. as it is just feeling.
Could you?
That's where I talked about the radar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
If they start going on and on about all their achievements, and you know, maybe they're not too humble, you know. I think an important one that's missed is, are they a good listener? So listen and learn is one of our values as well. And if you're in the interview process and they keep talking and interrupting you and, you know, that's probably a warning sign that they're maybe not a very good listener.
Yeah, that's a red flag, definitely.
Yeah.
Now technology is changing so fast, also AI technology, you are in the middle of AI technology. I mean, you have an AI-driven product. What kind of jobs do you think will disappear? Which jobs will stay? And which jobs will be newly created?
Just in general?
Yeah, just what's your what's your opinion, your perspective, your feeling about the future?
I mean, I think the impact is often underestimated. In the past, we've seen examples of technology, major technology shifts, you know, steam engine, television, radio, you know, music, CDs, you know, that were extremely disruptive. And each time there was a massive change, we thought, okay, this is going to be really detrimental to this, you know, to what are all these people going to do for work, right? And what ended up happening each time is that these people all found other jobs and learned new skills, and then there was a lot of jobs created within that new market, of course, right? The problem here with AI is that it's taking so many jobs so quickly that, you know, people don't have the time to learn new skills and to be placed in new positions. And yes, there are also some new jobs being created, but there's many, many, many more jobs being taken. And so that, you know, just being very honest, that's quite scary when we look for, I mean, just driving alone, you know, autonomous driving is going to put 2 billion people out of work.
Wow.
You know, there's 2 billion mm-hmm. people on the planet that are in some way, shape, or form mm-hmm. moving people or mm-hmm. Shipping or something from one place to another out of a job. In what we're doing, there's still a lot of growth. In healthcare, there's a lot of innovation, there's a lot of growth, and I'm very happy that we're working in a space where AI is doing a lot of good. And, you know, hopefully AI continues to do that in other sectors as well. But yeah, it's, you know, how is it going to change? It's already changing. I mean, we all feel the uses of even simple, you know, like ChatGPTs. And large language models are just getting smarter and smarter, and we're not probably not too far away from general intelligence, which is exciting and scary. I think one way that I'm looking forward to is personal companion, personal assistance, right? That's already happening in some form, but as that becomes, you know, more robotic, that's going to be very interesting. Personal assisting can be work related, can be personal life related, you know, scheduling appointments, work, friends, booking tickets, fly, you know, whatever, all that just done automated. And so the hope, right, is, and this is not me just saying, making this, we've heard this from a lot of AI experts in the world, that the hope is that there's a universal income. There's some way that we can enjoy the benefits of AI removing a lot of things that we don't want to spend time doing, giving us more time to do things that we want to do, be more creative, maybe spend more time with our friends and family, travel more. So that's the hope.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I have some more self-reflection questions. John, if you may allow, what is your superpower, the area you're a little bit better maybe than other people? And we were talking already about superpower at the beginning, so maybe something comes to your mind.
I don't know. I don't know if it's a superpower, but I like, I think I'm fairly good at staying calm in difficult situations. And I think that's important as a leader, a CEO, right? Because it, you know, everyone else is looking to you as, are we in trouble? And how much trouble are we in, you know? Or are we going to be fine? And so, and I think that comes not from having some gift or anything. I think it just comes from having gone through enough difficult times in the past before and coming out of it okay, or even in some cases better. So, and realizing that, okay, last time I was in a lot of trouble, it was fine. And the last time I panicked, I didn't have to panic. And so as that continues, this is now my fourth startup, you start to get a little bit thicker skin and you start to realize it's probably going to be fine. It may not be, but it's probably going to be fine.
So you get more resilience throughout your experience as an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And you need kind of a thick skin, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think humor is something that I try to throw in a lot in the workplace. Because, you know, it's tough being an entrepreneur. It's a lot of challenges. There's a lot of disappointments. There's a lot of frustration. And so as much as I can, I try to throw in some humor. I don't know. I don't think that's a superpower either. I think it's just something that I try to do.
Is there maybe a superpower you would like to have? Mm. Like any special talent?
Mm.
And you can now pick any talent you want. Like, yeah, you could also be, I don't know, flying or something like that.
I think I'm pretty good at finding good people to work with me on my journey. But if I could be even better at that, if that could be a superpower, I mean, that's everything. Because if you hire the right people, and it's clear, like in every organization, you know there's that one person in your company or two people in the company that just are brilliant. They excel in almost everything they do. And if you can multiply that company-wide, there's no stopping what you can create, right? So I think if I could have that as a superpower, that'd be pretty cool. Yeah.
Or there's the one that ruins the party, the one you don't want to hire as well.
Correct.
You
know? Yeah. So maybe having that ability both ways.
Mm. Yeah. Is there any personality or famous of, I don't know, celebrity maybe, a well-known person that you admire for certain character traits or abilities?
In any
field, could be anything.
I mean,
only business, any field.
Marie Curie, pretty impressive.
Good choice. Yeah.
She.
No, nobody picked her so far.
I mean, you know, she discovered two elements.
Hmm.
She pioneered the way for radiation therapy. That's by itself saved millions and millions of lives over generations. She's the first woman who ever won a Nobel Prize, the first person to win two Nobel Prizes, I think still the only person to win two Nobel Prizes. So she's pretty impressive.
Very impressive.
Anybody
else?
I mean, there's, you know, Isaac Newton. It's pretty impressive. By the age of 26, he'd already created calculus, laws of motion, discovered the laws of gravity. by 26, actually by 25.
Wow.
So he's pretty, you know. Tesla also, Nikola Tesla. Yeah. Unfortunately, didn't get a lot of credit for a lot of his inventions. But I mean, all entrepreneurs who were, you know, just geniuses and often working by themselves created pretty remarkable things.
Is there a phrase, a motto, like a mission statement, a credo you live by?
I think I try to live life in a kind of, you know, in a decent way and treat people with respect and try to be as grateful as I can. I journal every day and I write things that I'm grateful for that day. And that helps kind of rewire your mind because our brains are neuroplastic, and what ends up happening over time is that you start to think not just at the end of the day, what am I grateful for, but as things happen in the moment, something, you know, just as simple as I found a great parking space, right?
In Zurich,
right? And, you know, that's something that you think you take for granted, but then your because you've been doing this exercise every night, I've done it for now almost 10 years, you start in that moment being like, oh, I'm really grateful because that's going to save me some time, or it's going to, you know, whatever, and I'm going to be able to do more things, and, you know.
And how does it...
Or I didn't get a ticket.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Zurich, that's a
yeah.
climate.
That's a big achievement yeah. to drive a car. Yeah.
I got back to my yeah. car late yeah. and I didn't get a ticket.
Yeah.
That's, so grateful.
Yeah.
And what does this, you know, grateful exercise, what does that do to you?
I guess you go through life being a bit more appreciative. Things that happen in life, people who influence your life, who, you know, do kind things. That's another one of the things that I do every day, is I try to do something, you know, some act of random act of kindness, at least one a day.
So. As a final question, John, I would like to ask you, how will AI improve your life in 2 years?
So the personal assistant thing, I think yeah. that's coming, like as we speak, it's becoming more and more integrated into daily life, and that's going to be immeasurable. I mean, it's possible that even robots come into our daily life as well fairly soon, as, you know, more come out and price points get more affordable. I don't know if that's in 2 years, but it's probably very soon. Health. I think health is another big one, which hopefully you don't have to worry about, or I won't have to worry about in the next 2 years. But health, I mean, the healthcare system is so outdated and archaic, it's ridiculous.
All over the world?
Pretty much everywhere. You know, there's a few exceptions. There's a few hospitals that are exceptional. There's a few countries that are making strides, but by and large, it's incredibly outdated. There's a lot of hospitals that still use paper and pencil. So as AI starts to integrate more into healthcare systems, we're starting to see more and more improvement in patient outcomes. You know, a lot of things that patients used to have to come to the hospital, they don't have to anymore. They can do at home. But also, you know, like what we're doing, when you go to the hospital, you want to make sure that you leave better than you arrived, right? Not with even more complications. So, I think health and knowledge around what's good for you, what's not, is going to have a profound impact. It's already impacting a lot of people and patients around the world, but that will continue to accelerate significantly. Because it's an area that is so ripe for innovation and disruption.
So there's a lot of potential in the healthcare sector.
Huge. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
John Klepper, serial entrepreneur and founder of Pivroth, thank you so much for this really interesting, fascinating interview. I wish you all the success for your future and your company. And I'm looking forward to the next talk with you.
Thanks a lot, Jacob. Appreciate it.
Capricorn, connect people, potential, technology.